Navigate with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hello and welcome to episode number 124 of the Robots Podcast. My name is Jana and today is all about insect-inspired navigation, which we will discuss with Michael Mangan from the University of Edinburgh. But first, as always, here are the Robots News with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. Founder and main financial contributor to US company Willow Garage, Scott Hassan, has decided to wean the company from his funding. For the past 6 years, Willow Garage has become a major player in robotics with its robot operating system ROS and robots like the PR2, Turtlebot, or TechSci. During that time, it has pursued a mission to push the frontiers of robotics both scientifically and commercially with the unique goals of impact first, return on capital second. In terms of impact, it is hard to imagine a bigger success, at least in the non-commercial space. Today, all universities with a sizable robotics program have robots that run ROS, and the network of academic contributors to ROS far exceeds anything ever seen in robotics. Willow Garage has also led to commercial results, with 7 spin-off companies, including the Open Source Robotics Foundation. The foundation will continue to support ROS independent of the future of Willow Garage. Willow Garage itself has pledged to continue support for the 50 PR2 robots currently in use around the world. Willow Garage's funding still runs for roughly 3 months, during which the company will explore other funding models. We'll keep you posted on robohub.org.
Michael Mangan is a researcher in neuroinformatics and computational neuroscience at the University of Edinburgh in the UK. Michael takes inspiration from insects, such as ants and crickets, to explore locomotion and learn how we can make robots that are able to navigate unknown environments and difficult terrain. Our reporter Per spoke to Michael about his work, which advances the understanding of biology as well as potentially inspiring new developments in robotics.
Welcome to the Robots Podcast. I'm here at the Edinburgh University at the Informatics Centre, and I'm going to talk to Michael about his work with biological robotics, or robotics and biologic systems in combination. So could you tell us a bit how you got interested in robotics in general, and then how you came to choose this part of the field?
Sure. So my undergrad was in electrical engineering at Glasgow, and in my later years I started to do robotics courses, which sort of whet my appetite towards robotics. I then started doing some finding out about neural networks and genetic algorithms, so that gave me a bit of a biological feel within the robotics field. And at that point I then graduated and I was looking around, and I definitely knew I wanted to be in robotics, and I found the Institute of Perception, Action and Behaviour here at Edinburgh University. And specifically, I found my supervisor, Barbara Webb, who was doing a strange slant with robotics, whereby using robots more as a tool for understanding biological systems rather than just trying to develop robots that do a given task. So I found that quite an inspiring field, whereby it was more about understanding biology than it was finishing a goal.
So then you started to use them as a base, not only for as you said, designing robotic systems, but also to understand the biological systems. You're working very closely with the research, and you're even doing your own experiments on insects, I understand.
Yep, so I specifically studied desert ants, and my interest there was they had been studied for about 100 years. So my thinking as an engineer was these small animals with their tiny brains, generally less than 400,000 neurons for sure, and they're terrible sensors. They've got very unfocused eyes. They aren't able to focus, so they're very blurry. And I thought, we must know how they're navigating now, so I can use that for an engineering purpose. And I found out that actually we don't know what they're doing. So what my role has been recently is to be doing model-driven experiments whereby we look at how people think they're navigating. We think up ways of testing that, and we do our own biological work. And what we want to do is we want to test the robots in the same test as, exactly the same test as the biological system, so we can be very clear that everything matches. Exactly. And just because a model, I should be clear that just because a model is able to replicate what the biological system is doing doesn't mean that it is doing it the same way. Mm-hmm. But it's much stronger if you find that a model cannot do what the biological system is doing, mm-hmm. because then you can be sure that they're not doing things the same way.
Ah, that's a hard thing, that you need the negative evidence. How do you handle that problem? Because finding a good algorithm is...
So, for example, in my recent work, I was looking at crickets. I was also in a different system, and we gave crickets a different visual surrounding. So some models prefer very clear landmarks, so black and white edges, for example, was classically used. But other models can deal with very noisy surrounds. So we tested crickets and their way to navigate, or their navigational ability with these different visual surroundings. And we found that some models preferred as we hypothesized, some models preferred the edges and didn't perform so well with the natural surround, and vice versa. And what we found was that crickets actually preferred the natural surround. So some models actually were completely contrary to what the biological system did. And we were able to say, so it's unlikely that this is the algorithm being performed by the cricket.
Ah, interesting, because we actually know then how a cricket navigates.
Not so much, because I started with 5 and I got down to 2. So the next task is then to move on and to maybe try and think of an experiment which can separate these two models.
Ah, okay. So we know that either of the two is used, but we don't know which one.
I wouldn't be as strong as to say it's definitely these two that are being used, because someone could come along with a third model that also replicates all this data.
Ah, yeah, there we see the problem with negative proof.
Huh? Yeah, but what we can do is we can say that these ideas that were thought up previously, then they are definitely not what's doing. So my job is almost one of sort of whittling down the candidates.
Mm-hmm. Finding new ones and then testing them. And
exactly. So specifically, what I like to do is to be as unbiased as I can, where I take all the biologically plausible homing models, give them all every chance of working, and test them with in the same environment as the insect. So I also like to sample with cameras. I don't like to work in simulation very much.
No.
And the reason being there is that there's a lot of information in the real world that a simulation would either lose or it would abstract out. And some that could be very important for the experiment.
Do you want to talk about how you then implement this? Because is your aim then to use these experiences to build robots to do things? And how do you see that? What kind of tasks do you see that we would be likely to be apply these things to?
So specifically with the desert ants, they're amazing at navigating specifically in very hostile environments. So they go out when it's very, very hot. So the type of environments they're in is, for example, the Northern Sahara, where it's very featureless, and yet they can navigate there very well. But similarly, you'll find ants in semi-arid desert, like in Australia, and they also navigate there very well, and they learn very quickly what their environment's like. And they do this with a tiny brain. So where I see it being useful is maybe not in places where we have GPS and great maps, but where we're looking to map new places. So, for example, I can imagine space exploration. The Mars rover, I believe, already has biologically inspired techniques where they have path integration and such like, which ants use. Similarly, underwater, possibly.
Yeah, underwater is very hard because so few of our sensors work down there with any reliability. What I'm also seeing is that even if we have other forms of navigation in many environments like GPS and maps and stuff, maps are notoriously inaccurate and GPS is not always available. And it's not accurate to the sense that it's accurate to the centimeter or to the really local situation. An ant-sized robot would have very little use of GPS because the size of the ant is a thousandth the size of the resolution. So do you see it being able to use it in that and in those contexts too?
Yeah, certainly where GPS and stuff doesn't work, you know, where you don't have it in the first place. And yes, I also think what could be really interesting within that is that the ant brain is very small, yet it seems to perform very hard tasks. So it learns, for example, visual routes. So it memorizes these using visual cues.
Mm-hmm. Which means it must be very, very efficient.
Very efficient. So it's actually, it looks as if they're able to extract information from the environment and in a very efficient manner. And that's maybe something that would be very, very useful in robotics.
Yeah, certainly. Because if we have little data, we can process it fast and we can use cheap robotics, cheap hardware and software and whatever, or cheap hardware anyway. Yeah, that's really interesting. Because as you said, the sensors on these ants, the brain is very small, the sensors are terrible. Do they use, the desert ant doesn't use pheromones, as I understand, because it's too hot.
Yep, so it will use vision predominantly.
Yeah, so that means there are also only one kind of sensor. Do you try to replicate the use of other sensors that the ants have, or...?
So they do have a redundant system whereby the top of the eye is specially adapted such that they can see polarized light, which gives them a compass cue. They also measure distance traveled. So using distance traveled with compass direction allows them to path integrate, which gives them a lifeline back to the nest ultimately.
Yeah, because finding the nest in that environment must be very, very complicated.
Oh yeah, the nest entrance is generally, I would say, under an inch wide, and it's just a hole in the ground. There's no mound or anything for desert ants.
And also they are then traveling distances of how far from the nest would they forage? Is it 100 meters or 50 meters? Or
you're generally looking at distance. Our ants have been followed above 50 meters easily.
Yeah, so if you say that then the ant is... what, a quarter of an inch, and then the hole is an inch, and then they're 50 meters away, it'd be like us going over to Australia or something like that.
And the evolutionary pressure for an ant to get back to its nest is very strong. So their safety is the temperature. So a lot of other arthropods will be basically cooking on the surface. Oh, yeah. So the evolutionary pressure for them to get back home is very, very strong. So we would hope that evolution's maybe pushed us towards a good solution, if not optimal.
Yeah, and as I said, when they're doing something that complicated, which the other form of robots we're trying to build have a hard time doing with state-of-the-art hardware, and they've got 400,000 neurons, it looks like they could have a trick for very, very efficient algorithms.
That's what we'd be hoping.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, interesting. And you're also then also building insects, physical insects, to try them out. And load up the algorithms, so to speak, in these. Do you see the physical hardware having a trajectory forward?
I think there is possible uses there. So my primary stuff at the moment, I simulate the movement. It's not I take visual input from where the ants are navigating, and then simulate the robot movement. But also in the lab, we're also building, for example, a robot stick insect, which has exactly the same physical structure and dimensions as a stick insect. And we're looking to map the way that the animal combines different... It has a distributed control which drives its motion, and we're looking to replicate that. So I think certainly we have the classic problem of wheels don't go... They don't generally go off roads.
No. Wheels are great for some applications, but they're also terrible for many other applications. Yep.
So I think certainly legged motion is a good way to go. I've been very encouraged recently by the impressive work of Boston Dynamics.
Yeah. So the big dog is a four-legged creature, or whatever you would call it. These are six or eight, or are you working with more legs than six or eight?
No, we're always six for insects.
Yeah. But they also traverse some very complicated terrain, and they can also like go upside down and stuff.
Yeah, sure.
So I guess they use different gates for different terrain.
Yeah, so I'm not so versed in this literature, but yeah, I certainly know as well that they also move very quickly for the size that they are. And specifically, I think cockroaches are one of the fastest movers.
Yeah, body length per second.
So they've classically been studied for this type of behavior whereby you could build a robot that moves very quickly.
Yeah, and also in the energy efficient. Huh?
Yeah, I believe Stanford actually had a robot a number of years ago that was just... It was a cockroach inspired, and it was just looking for a speed record.
Do you think that, I mean, if we want to build robots that are significantly larger than the ants, do you think that there could be a problem with the algorithms and the way of doing things work on that scale, but not on the scale we might be interested in?
I think it depends what you abstract from what we learn. So I think the algorithm to move legs should be transferable, mm-hmm. whereas maybe I believe the exoskeleton is one of the limiting factors for insects and why they can't continue to get bigger.
The biggest insects I've seen is like a decimeter and a half or something, and they are, yeah.
And one of the limiters there is the exoskeleton structure. So I don't think we could actually build a gigantic ant, which is true to each.
Then you have to convert it to an interskeleton like we are again.
Exactly. And
on the other hand, it's probably also the other way around. You can't make really small stuff being like us. Then you have to be like an ant.
Exactly. So I think you can extract the knowledge of how they are.
Because that's really, I'm certain that there are many, many, many applications for the small things. For instance, environmental monitoring or pest control in farm and agriculture. Have you thought anything about applications?
In terms of moving within structures, I think, again, an unmapped environment is classically thought of as a disaster zone. So, for example, where you have maybe a building that's collapsed after an earthquake, there's been many people talked about smaller robots and how they could be used, especially if they're very cheap and in a swarm-type structure.
Drop them over and have them find somebody that's alive and guide.
Because it could be a very simple guidance whereby they're just looking, for example, for a heat signature. Mm-hmm. And if multiple of these robots, for example, were to be found in one space, mm-hmm. then they would probably have found a person. And this could be used in a very simple way just to, for example, guide rescuers and mm-hmm. such like. Yeah. So I could see possible uses like that.
Mm-hmm. For the really small size. Yeah.
Similarly, there's been a lot of progress recently, especially at Harvard, I believe. And they're looking at the RoboBee project.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this maybe has some interesting applications. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, a lot of people talk about that in terms of surveillance and such like.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a lot to be learned from insects. They're amazing flyers.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. And the bumblebee has got a huge payloads for the wing size, for instance,
exactly.
And stuff like that. It actually can fly.
Yeah. I think a lot of the problem is, as with a lot of other robot and other problems at the moment, is supplying power to anything that's autonomous. As in biology, we have a very good way of using energy. We're very energy efficient, and
maybe that's something we could learn from the insects too, on how they are this energy efficient as they are, and how they store and use their energy.
I think there's certainly a gap in devices, and this doesn't just relate to the insects with the modular robotics. I think it's a little bit the same, whereby we've classically always used servos, for example, which are high voltage, high power. Mm-hmm. They add their own weight, for example. And I think we've been speaking for some time about, for example, air muscles mm-hmm. and such like. And I think that could be one of the real steps where that will then drive the devices, mm-hmm. which allow robots to really step out of the lab and industrial uses, I think.
Mm-hmm. Because they're also compliant. You can make them. Servos are harder to use in many situations as compared to the air muscles.
I don't know if just through history that servos have maybe came from a slightly different starting point.
Yeah.
And therefore we're maybe crowbarring them into a situation where they're not specifically suited. And something more natural. It may be biologically inspired, maybe not. For example, tendons, I think, I've been reading up about tendons recently, and the conversion ratio of what they can store and then dissipate is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and also, if you're looking at, I'm really fond of the tensegrity structures that consist of fixed struts and variable wires. And the wire is really efficient. It can transfer both load in the sense that it can take a pulling load, and also it can also provide force. Actuation over distance.
Yeah.
So you could have the force generator close to your body, but you could generate power outside in your finger.
Yeah.
And that makes the arm lighter and yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I really like the tensegrity, the tendon system. The tendon system then is like a spring that loads up with energy and then discards the energy, but can also regain it like for instance a kangaroo. It's
exactly
just adding the energy it's lost.
Yeah. So I think this could be one of the, and this is more of a materials issue. Maybe we have to speak to the mechanical engineers more than informatics. But
it's also so that I think you need different controls, because if you have tendons and you have wires, it's not as predictable.
Yeah, this is very true. Yeah.
As a servo, if you tell a servo to go a certain distance in a certain time, it will do it, and it will do it with very, very nice repeatability. if you're using tendons, it's not going to be. So your algorithms have to be not much more noise tolerant.
I agree. Then you're moving towards sort of stochastic algorithms, which is very much the flavor of the month within biological modeling at the moment. Very much looking at Bayesian approaches, whereby your prior can shift. For example, as your tendon changes its performance, you would also learn to adapt to that. And that would also be possibly an inspiration from biological systems.
Yeah. And I mean, all animals actually do that. I don't know if insects don't have tendons, right? But they do have muscles, and they're also compliant. So they actually take this into account already.
Yeah, well, the insects, I don't know how much they would change over the course of their life. The foragers are only out there for around a week. So I guess,
it's hard to know, huh?
But yeah, I'm not too sure of the answer to that one.
Yeah? Something we'll have to try to find out.
I'll add that to the list.
Yeah, I guess it's a long list. So how long have you been doing this work?
So I've just finished my PhD last year. Mm-hmm. Then I moved into the modular robotics stuff for a while. Mm-hmm. And now I'm back in academia doing a three-year postdoc looking at similar navigational stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Could you tell us a bit about what you did in the modular robotics community?
Yep, so I worked together with my colleague Tom Larkworthy. Tom had been a lab mate of mine who was studying modular robotics or self-reconfiguring modular robotics for his PhD. And we looked to try to develop a product at the end of that. So we were both looking at developing an actual device, mm-hmm. and similarly, actually trying to market this device to take it to sell it. It wasn't a research grant.
It was commercially orientated.
Exactly, and we were at that for around a year, mm-hmm. and we went through a couple of prototypes. We were developing a bipartite system, so we had.
I like that division too.
Which was commercially driven. It was that was the idea with that was we can have an expensive component which takes a lot of the load and does the self-reconfiguring. And then there's a cheaper modular component which can act just the structure in its most basic sense, maybe passing power and communications, but essentially it's very passive. And then also
very much less complicated and cheaper and everything.
Exactly. And in this way, we envisaged that people would almost have a pick and mix type robot where they would select the components for the applications that they thought they would use. And also this would give them the opportunity to add new components later on, but use the same basic kit so that they could keep coming back.
Yeah, that's why I love the modular robotics part. It's just the flexibility.
Exactly.
And the modular and the self-reconfiguring put together is such an enormously powerful concept. Did you see any synergies between your work with animal and the insect world and modular robotics? That would be interesting to note.
Well, the thing, I study the desert ant, and one of the reasons for studying that is that they don't use pheromones, and so each of them navigate individually, so they're autonomous agents.
And that's, all modules are also autonomous agents.
Yeah, but also there isn't so I could see a real synergy with the sort of swarm robotics, and, you know, where you could have multiple modules, and they're all quite not so intelligent, and there isn't maybe an overall controller. But by some form of synergy, they actually produce the end behavior that you wish. But unfortunately, specifically in my research, I looked for animals that weren't using a social navigational technique, such that I could study them easier.
Ah, yeah, yeah, okay, okay.
So, but I could certainly see a synergy between...
Because they're similar in that sense, huh?
Yeah, and what we see with biology is that there isn't an overall controller telling the ants how to do something.
No. It's not even a boss home in the hive.
It's just a stigmergy of a lot of simple behaviors, which when you aggregate over the entire colony, it produces, for example, nest building, foraging, grooming and whatnot. And I think there could be an interesting things to learn from biology that we could maybe apply.
Yeah, because we don't want to build in a central controller for that's going to sit and talk to these millions of units. It basically isn't even possible to do it that way, because there would be so much communication that it wouldn't work.
Yeah, you would just completely break down.
Yeah, yeah. So that's really interesting. Then you're back in academia again, and then you're studying the ants and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're going to do that. You've done that for how long?
I've been at this now for just a few months, so I've just started a three-year.
Basically 3 years left.
Yeah, I've got a 3-year grant, whereby I'm looking at how these ants are navigating. So a direct follow-on from my PhD. Mm-hmm. So taking the results that were there, going and sampling more of the ant world, sampling for the entire lifetime of an ant, and in this way I can test some of the best robot models given exactly the same input as the ants, and seeing whether our robot models can actually, can they even navigate within this really tough visual surrounding? And then if they do, what can I break them ultimately by limiting their visual input
You're going to degrade the visual input until it doesn't work anymore.
Exactly.
And then you know the limit.
And at the same time, I can work up from people who have proposed ideas at the ant level and maybe work up from the bottom up at the same time.
Ah, and then you could actually pinpoint where it... Yeah,
yeah, start to put the two things together ultimately.
Mm, very interesting, huh?
And the idea there would be that hopefully, given that the sensors that the ant have, as we've discussed, are really poor, this might inspire the people who are doing the high-end robot solutions to think about what it is from the environment they actually need, and whether they can do that in a simpler manner.
Yeah, and as we said, do you do it in a simpler manner? It's cheaper, it's more robust, whatever. So thank you for being part of the podcast, and I would be excited to come back in 3 years and see what kind of results you had.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem, thanks.
And thank you for listening.
And that's it for today. If you've become curious about Michael's work or any of the work of other researchers that are featured in the podcast, you can find a wealth of extra information on the podcast website at robotspodcast.com. The next episode will air in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Navigate with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.